making constant but ineffectual efforts to check the alarming drip. We passed fresh tracks of oryx and of rim, the large white gazelle which is found in the sands, and knew that if we followed these tracks, they would lead us to fresh grazing. But we could not afford to lengthen our journey. In the afternoon of the sixth day, the dune chains turned into gentle downs. But we had already climbed over 16 of them that day, and on one of them a baggage camel collapsed, only moving again when we unloaded her. Bin Kabina's camel went lame in the shoulder, and all the others showed signs of exhaustion. I knew that it would be another 10 days before we reached the Hasi, and I began to wonder if we should get there. Next morning, we came on the fresh tracks of a pelican, which had walked in a straight line across the sand. I tried to remember what it said in the Bible about a pelican in the wilderness. Amir told me that 5 years earlier he had seen several very large white birds near Mugshin, and that they had left tracks like these. While he was describing these birds, we topped a rise and saw that the rolling sands ahead of us were green with cassis, growing in tasseled tufts a foot high. We unloaded and turned our camels loose. I knew that this grazing was going to make all the difference to our chance of reaching the Hasi, since it would not only satisfy the camels' hunger, but would also alleviate their thirst. We camped on a floor of hard sand in the shelter of a small dune. Two twisted abal bushes, one of them with a broken branch drooping to the ground, three clumps of cassis beside which I had placed my saddlebags, a pile of camel droppings, and a low bank of sand marked with a tracery of lizards' tracks, combined with our scattered possessions to become our home. There were similar places all around us, but because Bin Gabesha happened to call out, "Stop! Over there!" and we had gone where he had directed, this particular spot acquired a temporary significance. This camping place was memorable because of the grazing, but I always thought each one distinctive at the time. The curious shape of some sticks beside the fire, a sprinkle of white on golden sand where Bin Kabina had spilt flour, a rope lying where a camel had jerked it as she rose. Such trifles seemed to distinguish each camp from others. But in fact, the differences were too insignificant, and the memory of them soon blurred. All but a few tended to become just one of a thousand others. Bin Kabina and Bin Gabesha were preparing food, and they called out to us, where we lay idly in the sun, that they were going to make porridge flavoured with sugar and butter. Porridge was wasteful of water, but now, contentedly watching the camels ripping succulent mouthfuls from the rich feeding around them, we cheerfully condoned the extravagance. After the meal, Bin Gabesha and Sadr went off to hunt, but came back empty-handed at sunset, saying they had seen a herd of 20 oryx and many rim, but could not get near them. We decided to leave the camels out to graze during the night, feeling that here we were safe from attack. In the morning, the red one, the best of our baggage camels, had strayed, and it took Amir 2 hours to find her and bring her back. No camel will ever remain contentedly in one place, however good the grazing, but even though hobbled, will wander farther afield looking for something better. The red one was particularly bad at straying, and the others usually followed along behind her. Bin Kabina's camel and Omer's had become inseparable, while mine showed a preference for the Miri, an ugly grey, which we had bought in the Raidat because she was in milk. At first she refused to give us any, although her calf had already been weaned, but Amai sewed up her anus, saying he would not undo it until she let down her milk. After that, she gave us about a quart a day. These Bedu allow a camel to suckle her calf without interference for about 6 weeks. They then cover her udder with a bag, only allowing the calf to drink before they milk her in the morning and evening. They wean it after 9 months. A camel will remain in milk for as long as 4 years, provided she is not served by a bull. She may have as many as a dozen calves, and has a working life of about 20 years. These Arabs keep a piece of skin from a calf which has been slaughtered or has died before it was weaned, and allow the camel to smell it before they milk her. Otherwise she would not let down her milk. It was a crisp morning with a gentle breeze. A few white cumulus clouds deepened the blueness of a sky no longer tinged with yellow. Muhammad looked critically at the camels as Omer and Bin Gabesha drove them towards us and remarked, "They look better now. God willing, they will be able to reach the Hassi. Anyway, we may find more grazing. It looks as if there is a lot in the sands this year. But it is very scattered." It only took us 10 minutes to load, and as we moved off, I thought how pleasant it was to be free from the burden of possessions. We walked across the red downs, and half an hour later came to the end of the grazing. Sadr told me that we had been camped on its eastern edge, and that it only extended for 4 or 5 miles to the west. We could easily have missed it. A little later, finding some broken ostrich eggs, Bin Kabina and Amir argued whether ostriches were lawful food, a purely academic point, since ostriches had been extinct in southern Arabia for more than 50 years, although a few survived until recently in the Wadi Sirim in northern Arabia. When I was in Syria, a Bedou told me that the Ruwala had shot one there just before the war. It may well have been the last of them. My companion stopped to show me what their tracks looked like, saying that their grandfathers had known these birds. I had seen plenty of the tracks of the African ostrich, a larger bird than the Arabian, in the Sudan, and the copies which Omer made in the sand were correct. It is sad to think that the Arabian oryx and rim are also doomed as soon as cars penetrate into the southern desert. Unfortunately, oryx prefer the hard, flat sands and gravel plains to the heavy dunes. Since they differ from the 4 species to be found in Africa, it means that yet another kind of animal will soon be extinct. In Saudi Arabia, during the last few years, even gazelle have become rare. Hunting parties scour the plains in cars, returning with lorry loads of gazelle, which they have run down and butchered. Every mile or so, I checked our course with my compass. It was difficult to hold everything. The compass, notebook, pencil, camel stick and head rope, especially when the camel fidgeted. I had dropped my stick for the second time when Bin Kabina, who jumped down from his camel to pick it up, said as he handed it back to me, "Really, Mbarak, this is too much. If I were you, I should divorce her as soon as you get back." The Bedou have a saying that whenever a man drops his stick, his wife is being unfaithful. We went on till evening without finding pasturage. When we camped, we could see the dark plain of the Jelida 6 miles away. Bin Dasan had told me that the Jelida linked up with the plain of Abu Ba, which in turn merged into the plains running down from the Hassa to Jabrin. He had also told me that when we reached the Jelida, we should be halfway to the Hassi, but that the big and difficult sands would still lie ahead of us. He had explained that the Arad escarpment, which ran south from the Hassi, would then be about 50 miles to the west. Next day we travelled across the Jelida plain. Its surface was of coarse sand and fine gravel, covered in places with small angular pebbles, highly polished by the wind. They were of many kinds. I recognized pieces of porphyry, granite, rhyolite, jasper and limestone. There were occasional ridges, some of them 20 feet in height, of the quartz conglomerate that underlies the gravel surface of the plain, but these were easily avoided. We travelled fast until midday, when we came on grazing and stopped for 2 hours. I wandered off to a distant ridge, glad to be alone for a while, and sat watching formless shadows dapple an umber-coloured plain, where nothing else moved. It was very still, with the silence which we have driven from our world. Then Bin Kabina shouted to me, and I went back. Coffee was ready. Muhammad said, "We thought you were going after those oryx." And when I asked, "Which oryx?" he stared at me in amazement. I looked where he pointed, and saw them at once. 18 white dots on the dark plain. Bin Kabina said, "If they had been Arabs, you would have sat there without seeing them until they came and cut your throat." Bedou are always observant. Even when they are engrossed in an argument, their dark, restless eyes notice everything, and their minds record it. They never daydream. We found no more grazing, and camped at last on flat, empty sands beyond the Jelida. We passed much oryx spoor, and saw 28 of them during the day. In the afternoon, Bin Gabesha and I stalked three, which we saw ahead of us. As we were getting near them, I heard someone calling. Looking round, I saw Salih hastening towards us. I thought, they have seen Arabs and don't want me to shoot. When he came up, he said, "Look out, or you will give them your wind." I whispered furiously, "I hunted animals before you were born. It is you who will frighten them by making such a beastly noise." Whereupon he merely added to my exasperation by maintaining that Oryx did not mind the sound of voices, an inexplicable belief held by some of the Bedou, which probably explains why so few of them succeed in shooting one. I had to take a long shot. I saw that I had hit the one I had fired at, but they all galloped off. We hurried forward and found bloodstains on the ground. When the camels arrived, we followed the Oryx, but they were going to the southeast, and after a while the others refused to go on, saying that we could not afford to lengthen our march by going in the wrong direction. This was so obviously true that I was forced to agree. 2 days later, we reached the Bani Marad. Looking at the mountainous dunes which stretched across our front, I realized that our real difficulties were only now beginning. Fortunately, the prevailing winds were different from those in the sands to the south of the Jalida, and in consequence the easier slopes faced south. Even so, they imposed a severe strain on our tired camels. They had had only one full meal in the 11 days since we had left Manwak. If these southern faces had been steep, as in the Iruk al-Shaiba the year before, we should never have got over them. Each dune was 300 to 400 feet in height, and the highest peaks were built up round deep crescent-shaped hollows. It took us an hour or more to cross each range. Their northern faces fell away in unbroken walls of sand into successive valleys, 2 miles or more across, which ran down from the Arad escarpment and continued until they disappeared from sight, 20 miles or more to the east. So far, the sands we had passed on this journey had been dreary and uninteresting. Now, for the first time, the dunes were a lovely golden red, and although I was tired, hungry, and thirsty, their shapes gave me great pleasure. Once across the Bani Marad, we were on the southern edge of the hard pastures, on which the Bedou graze their camels. But ours were too thirsty to eat this plant. At midday we came upon tracks, less than a week old, of Arabs and camels, and from now on two of us scouted continuously ahead. We were uncomfortably aware that our own tracks would show any Arab that we had come from the south. A very strong north wind added to our discomfort by filling our eyes and ears with sand, without, however, hiding our tracks, which remained clearly visible in the valley bottoms, where the ground was covered with a mosaic of highly polished limestone fragments. About 4 o'clock, we decided to stop, so that we could cook a meal and put out the fire before dark. Salih remained to keep watch behind us, and we turned eastwards along the top of the next dune instead of crossing it. Half an hour later, we unloaded in a hollow in the downs where our camels could graze without showing themselves upon a skyline. Sadr and Bin Gabesha stood guard while Muhammad herded the camels, and the rest of us gathered wood and baked bread. The sky was overcast, and I could see that it was raining heavily to the west. When it grew dark, we couched the camels, and waited for Salih to come. He arrived an hour later to report that no one was following us. We fed. Everything was cold from the long wait, the coffee, the bread, and the watery gravy from shark meat. It was still blowing strongly, and now it had begun to rain. We dared not light a fire, and sat talking in whispers. I had just decided to get into my sleeping bag when Bin Gabesha signed to us to be quiet and pointed to the camels. They had stopped chewing, and all of them were staring in one direction. Our rifles were already in our hands. During these days we never put them down, and we slid quietly to the ground, crawling to the edge of the small basin in which we had camped. It was too dark to see anything, but the camels still watched something, although now they were looking farther to our right. I lay there motionless, straining to see what they saw. Shadows formed and reformed, but I could be sure of nothing. Bin Kabina lay beside me. I touched him inquiringly, but he made a sign that he too could see nothing. The cold rain, which had soaked through my shirt, ran down my flanks and pattered on my bare legs. The camels started to chew the cud again and were no longer watching. I thought uneasily, they are working round behind us. Amer and Bin Gabesha evidently thought the same, for they moved farther round to watch the night behind us. Hours later I crawled to my saddlebags to fetch a blanket, which I shared with Bin Kabina. The rest of the night passed very slowly, and nothing happened. In the morning, Bin Gabesha found the tracks of a wolf that had circled our camp. Muhammad said disgustedly, "God! Fancy spending the whole night sitting in the rain, staring my eyes out, trying to see a wolf." And Bin Gabesha answered, "Better be cold and wet than wake up with a dagger in your ribs." Wet, cold, and tired, we started early on a cloudy, sunless morning. Later the sun came through, and it was very hot, and my thirst grew worse and worse. We passed more fortnight-old tracks of Arabs and their herds. Ahead of us, Sadir and Bin Gabesha scanned each slope and hollow before they signed to come on. The rest of us dragged the trembling camels up the slopes and held them back as they ploughed down the far side of each dune in cascades of sand. It was weary work, and all the time I felt that we were being watched. The dunes were now about 500 feet high, and at the western end of each valley we could at last see the dark wall of the Arad. We stopped after 9 hours, when the camels could go no farther, again cooking a quick meal before sunset, and eating it in the dark after Saba, who had been watching our tracks, had joined us. For the first time on this journey, there was a heavy dew. We slept fitfully, jerking to wakefulness whenever a camel stirred. It was fine and clear when we started again at sunrise. 2 hours later, one of the baggage camels lay down and refused to move, until, at Amer's suggestion, we poured a little water down her nostrils, which revived her. We reached the Arad at 1 o'clock, and camped 2 hours later in a shallow watercourse on the limestone plateau. We were across the sands. The valleys, when I woke at dawn, were filled with eddying mist, above which the silhouettes of the dunes ran eastwards, like fantastic mountains towards the rising sun. The sky glowed softly with the colours of the opal. The world was very still, held in a fragile bowl of silence. Standing at last on this far threshold of the sands, I looked back, almost regretfully, the way we had come. We reached the Hasi 3 days later, after travelling northward across a gravel plain scattered with pieces of limestone. The precipitous western edge of the Arad was on our left. Beneath it were the three shallow wells of Zifra, and 30 miles to the north of them was the deep brackish well of Karia, among the ruins of a Sabaean city. According to Sara, the well mounds of Mankali, believed by the Bedu to be the wells of the Bani Ad, lay at the southern end of the Arad, and their lost city of Ad under the sands of Jaman, a further day's journey to the south. Muhammad was, however, convinced that this city, one of the two mentioned in the Quran as having been destroyed by God for arrogance, was buried in the sands to the north of Habarut. He reminded me of the many clearly defined tracks which converge on these sands, and which the Rashid maintain once led to that city. Sadr pointed beyond the sands of Bani Ram to some peaks visible far to the west, which were, he said, in the foothills of the Hajjaz. And I told them how I had visited that country 2 years before. When I told them that I had ridden through it on a donkey, they scoffed at me, and we argued happily as we went along. On the second day, after leaving the sands, we camped in the stream bed of the Hanu, that runs down to Karia. And next morning, as we rode along the track to the Hasi, we came unexpectedly on 8 mounted yam, whose rifles were slung under their saddles, while ours were in our hands. We were only a few yards from them. I saw Bin Gabesha slip his safety catch forward. There was an old man opposite me, and though his face was muffled in his headcloth, I could see the hatred in his eyes. No one moved or spoke. The silence was heavy between us. At last I said, "Salam alaikum," and he replied. A boy whispered to him, "Are they Mishkas?" And he snarled back without taking his eyes off us, "Don't you know the tribes? Don't you know the foe?" Muhammad said that we came in peace, that we were Rashid from the eastern sands on our way to visit Ibn Saud, adding that our main party was close behind, and advising them to be careful when they met them. We then rode on. I wondered uneasily what we should have done with them if we had surprised them in the sands. Perhaps if we had taken their rifles and their camels, we could have let them live. 20 minutes later, we were at the Hasi. It was 16 days since we had left Manwakh. Having watered our camels and filled our skins, we learned from some women that Ibn Saud's guardian on the well had just gone off with his son to look for a strayed camel. Sadir and Salih were anxious to seize this opportunity and slip away before he returned. We loaded their camels, which were still in good condition, with all the food and water that they could carry. And as the women had told us that the yam had all moved westwards a week ago, and that the sands to the south were empty, we hoped that they would be all right. To avoid arousing suspicion, we told the women that they were going to fetch one of our camels, which had collapsed 2 days earlier. We whispered our farewells, embraced them, and they left us. They arrived safely in Manwakh, as I later heard from Bin al-Kamam, when I met him on the Trucial coast. There was nothing for us now to do but to go to Sulayl and hope for the best. Our camels were in need of rest. We had very little food and no guide. Even if we had been able to slip away, a pursuit party would certainly be sent after us. The guardian of the well, a yam, returned next day and made no attempt to conceal his dislike of us. When he learned that I was a Christian, he refused to drink the coffee we offered him, saying that I was an infidel, and that my companions, as Muslims, who had sold themselves into the service of an infidel for gold, were even worse. Virtually under arrest, we went with him to Sulayl, where we arrived 2 days later. The oasis extended for about 2 miles along the Wadi Dawasir, and the settlement itself consisted of 5 small villages. On our way to the village where the Amir lived, we passed fields of wheat and lucerne, watered from trip buckets, raised from the wells by animals descending ramps. There were palms to the west of the village. The yam led us down narrow, twisting lanes. Some men called out, asking who we were, and he answered scornfully, "An infidel and his servants." We stopped at the Amir's house, flat-roofed and made of mud like all the others. Rather to my surprise, the Amir, who was a young slave, received us graciously. He showed us to an empty house with a courtyard on the outskirts of the village, and, after saying that we should, of course, feed with him, told us that we must remain at Sulayl until he heard from Ibn Saud. He and one of his retainers, a Mura who knew the Rashid, and 2 young wireless operators, were the only friendly people. Everyone else was fanatical and unpleasant. The elders spat on the ground whenever we passed, and the children followed me round, chanting derisively, "Al-Nazrani! Al-Nazrani!" the name by which these Arabs know a Christian. In the evening we bought lucerne, but only Muhammad's camel would eat it. When after supper we gave the Amir an account of our journey, he said, "You do not realize how lucky you have been to get here. I should not have thought that you would have had a chance. The sands you came through were filled with Arabs until a week ago, when most of them moved westward across the Arad to better grazing. If a single Arab had seen you, the hue and cry would have been out, for they would have known at once that you are from the south. Didn't you know that Ibn Saud has given permission to his tribes to raid the Mishkas and to kill any of them they meet, in revenge for the recent raids on the Yam and the Dawasir? They are wildly excited here at having permission to raid after years of enforced peace. Many parties have gone off, and others are getting ready to go. Any of them would have killed you out of hand if they had met you. Nothing could have saved you if they had found that one of you was a Christian. These tribes are the last of the Akhwan. Even in this village, where they are under control, you can see how they hate you as an infidel." He looked at me, shook his head, and said again, "By God, you were lucky!" I knew he was right, and realized how badly I had misjudged our chances. This realization increased the responsibility I felt towards my companions, who had appreciated the true risks, and yet had come with me. 2 days later, the Emir came to our room to tell me he had received orders by wireless from Ibn Saud to detain the Englishman and to imprison his companions. He removed our rifles and daggers, told me to remain where I was, leaving the mullah as a guard, and ordered Muhammad and Amer to follow him. He said that Bin Kabina and Bin Gabesha, who were herding the camels, could wait till the evening. When I protested at being separated from my companions and asked that we should be treated alike, he said he must obey the king's orders, but allowed me to send a telegram to Ibn Saud. After several efforts, I composed a telegram saying that we had been travelling in the empty quarter and had come to the Hussy for water. I asked for his forgiveness, adding that if he wished to punish anyone, I was solely to blame, since my companions, who had no knowledge of this country, had gone where I wished, and that it was I who had guided them. In the evening I saw Bin Kabina and Bin Gabesha coming towards the village with the camels. They looked very cheerful, laughing and joking together. The Murrah allowed me to meet them and tell them what had happened. Seeing me, some children called out, "Now the king will cut off the Christian's head and the heads of his companions." I was so distressed that I could hardly speak. They had trusted me, and I wondered unhappily whether they were now going to suffer for it. I felt worse about them than I did about the others, for they were so much younger. They asked a few questions, and then Bin Kabina put his hand on my shoulder and said, "Don't worry, Mubarak. If God wills, all will be well." At sunset, the Amir did his best to cheer us up with a meal in his house, but it was an unhappy evening. Hours later, when I was half asleep, the door was thrown open. A large black slave came in, swinging a pair of fetters, and ordered me to get up and go with him at once, as the Amir of the Wadi had arrived. I followed through silent streets to the Amir of Sulayl's house. The room was packed with people. An elderly bearded man in a brown, gold-embroidered cloak returned my formal greeting, bidding me sit opposite him. His clerk, a shifty-looking, self-important slave, whom I disliked on sight, was bullying Amer. "Don't lie," he shouted after every answer. "You only know how to lie." Eventually the Amir asked me where we came from and why. I explained that I had come from the Hadramut, that I had been exploring and shooting oryx in the empty quarter, and having run out of water, had come to the Hussy. I told him that the Rashid, who were with me, knew neither the country nor where we were going. He asked me how in that case we had found the Hussy, and I said that Philby had marked it on the map, and that the two Tsar who had been with us had known where it was, having visited it from Najran. I said they had gone back when we reached this well. I insisted that I alone was to blame for having come here, and accepted all responsibility. Later, after coffee and tea had been handed round, the Amir of the Wadi said I must go with him to Dam, and that one of my companions could come with me. I asked for Bin Kabina. Eventually the two of us climbed into the back of the Amir's truck. The slave who had fetched me from my room got in with us, still holding the fetters. After the Amir, his clerk, and the driver had mounted in front, we drove off to the west. It was very cold. The car lurched and bumped, and Bin Kabina was carsick. He had told me as we waited to get into the car that all four of them had been put in the stocks, when suddenly a messenger arrived and asked which was Bin Kabina. I said the Amir had given permission for one of them to accompany me, and that I had asked for him. He replied, "You should have asked for Muhammad. He is the eldest." At last we arrived at another village, and stopped in front of a large castle. The slave informed us that we were at Dam. We followed the Amir inside, and he gave orders for tea and coffee to be made, and a fire to be lit, where we could warm ourselves. He told me that he had seen my telegram to the king, and said, "Don't worry, I am sure that all will be well." Then he bade us good night, and left the room. The slave came in again with some quilts for our bedding. He asked if we wanted more coffee, and when we refused, helped himself and went out. The fire died down, and the room grew very dark. The wind banged a loose shutter throughout the night. 12. From Sulayl to Abu Dhabi. After our release, we planned to travel eastwards to the Trucial Coast. We visit Layla, where we are refused a guide, but make our own way to Abu Dhabi. We were in a small bare room at the top of the castle. We had been given bread and tea at dawn, but since then no one had come near us. It was now nearly 11 o'clock. Bin Kabina, silent and depressed, had covered himself again with his blanket, and I wondered if he was asleep. Every now and again I could hear a wheel creaking on a well, but on looking out of the window could see nothing but a drab plain, where the wind spun eddies of dust among leafless bushes. In the distance I could just make out the dark wall of the Arad. The night had seemed very long, for I had not slept. I had been haunted by the memory of three boys whom I had seen a few months earlier sitting outside a village in the Tehama. Each of them nursed in his lap a bundle of stained wrappings, which concealed the suppurating stump of his right hand. Their hands had been cut off simply because they had been circumcised in a manner which the king had forbidden. I could not forget the twitching face and pain-filled eyes of one gentle, delicate-looking youth. I had been told that when the Amir's slave hesitated to execute this savage punishment, he held out his hand, saying, "Cut, I am not afraid." I had lain there in the dark, dreading that some such punishment might be inflicted on Bin Kabina and my other companions, as a warning to others not to bring foreigners into Saudi Arabia without permission, and that if I was taken away to Jeddah, I should never know their fate. However, these forebodings were dispelled when the door opened and the Amir came in. Smiling, he said cheerfully, "I told you it would be all right. Abdullah Filby spoke to the king on your behalf, and the king has given orders that you are to be released and allowed to go on your way." Filby, who is a Muslim, had lived in Riyadh for many years, and was a regular attendant at the king's court. I had seen him recently in London, and had told him that I planned this journey. He came to meet me at Layla a few days later, and then he told me what had happened. The Amir now asked where I proposed to go, so that he could inform the king. I told him that I would like to go to Layla, and to cross from there to the Trucial Coast. He said that the car was waiting and would take me back to Sulayl. We drove down the Wadi Dawasir, passing through the gap which separates the Arad from the main Tubak range to the north. The cliffs of the Arad were here about 800 feet high. We went to the Amir of Sulayl's house, where the others were waiting for us, having spent a cold night in the stocks. Bin Gabesha said, "By God, if I had realized that they were going to do this to me, they would never have caught me when I had a rifle in my hand and a camel under me." But they were as relieved as I was that nothing more had happened to them. We arranged to go to Layla next day. We had little food left, but agreed that it would be better to buy what we needed there than tire our camels by carrying it. Two Yam dined with the Amir that night, and after we had fed, one of them told us how he had killed Bin Dualan. The lamp smoked and gave little light, and the room was filled with weird shadows. The embers glowed on the coffee hearth, and wisps of smoke were bitter in our nostrils. Outside, a rising wind pressed at the badly fitting door. I watched the man as he told his story, speaking slowly and with many pauses. He was leaning forward and occasionally stroked his pointed black beard with a thin, small hand. His face was framed in the white folds of his headcloth, which was topped with a simple black head rope. He had great dignity, and was unmistakably a desert Arab, passionate yet austere. "It was late in the morning," he said. "Three of my relatives had unsaddled at my tent, and we were drinking coffee, while my son was skinning the goat we had killed for them. Suddenly, we heard the sound of firing to the south. Very many shots. We gave the alarm and ran to fetch our camels. While we were mounting, a small herds boy rushed up, shouting out that my uncle's camp was being attacked by Mishkas. Many, many Mishkas. He cried to me to hurry, saying that they had already killed Salim and Jabir, who was my nephew, and that they were taking all the camels. 12 of us gathered from the surrounding tents, and we rode to their help. As we got near my uncle's tents, we saw 5 Mishkas, God's curse on all Mishkas, jump on their camels and ride off. They were dressed only in dark loincloths. They had been looting the tents, and one of them carried a rug. The women were wailing round the body of my nephew, God have mercy on him. And as we galloped past, they shouted that the main body of Mishkas was already gone, taking all the camels, and they cried on us for vengeance. We galloped after the few we could see, and we were gaining on them when they reached some low dunes covered with bushes. They stopped there and fired on us. The plain was as bare as this floor, and we could only get near them from the north, where there were other dunes. They had already killed one of us. We could not see them. Do you understand? We got off our camels and ran towards them through the dunes. There was much firing. We killed 3 of them, and they had killed another of us and wounded 2 more. Then we killed another, and knew that there was only one left. He was somewhere among the big dunes, and every time one of us moved he fired, and he never missed. He had killed 4 of us, and still we could not see him, though we knew where he was. I realized that he was very close, with only the crest of a dune between us. I and my cousin crawled slowly up it towards him. Then my cousin lifted his head to look as we neared the top of the dune and fell back dead beside me, shot through the forehead. I saw the barrel of a rifle jerking. By God, it was less than 8 paces from where I lay. I realized that the rifle had jammed. I drew my dagger and leapt on the man before he could get to his feet. I drove my dagger into his neck and killed him. He was a little man, and was armed with an English rifle. He stopped speaking, and fetched a rifle from the corner and held it out to me, saying, "This was the rifle." And he also had a pair of field glasses hung round his neck. Later someone recognized him, and told us that he was Bindu Allen, the cat. I said that he had travelled with me the year before, and that I had given him the field glasses. The Yam said, "Yes, we have heard of you as the Christian who travels with the Mishkas, and we thought that you had probably given him this rifle." But I replied, "No, he captured that from a government post in the Hadramaut quite recently." After a pause he said, "By God, he was a man. He knew how to fight. I thought he would kill us all." He told us that in this raid the Mishkas had killed 14 Yam and captured 130 camels, and that 9 Mishkas had been killed. He added, "Now that the king has given us permission to raid them, we shall, if God wills, recover our camels, and capture many others, and, by God, we shall kill every Mishkas we see. By God, you were lucky that we did not find you before you got here." We left Sulayil next morning, the 29th of January. Laila was 160 miles away, and Abu Dhabi on the Trucial coast was at least 600 miles beyond that, twice as far from here as Manwak, from where we had started our journey. It took us 8 days to reach Laila. Our camels were tired, and Muhammad's camel and 3 of the baggage camels had large saddle swellings. The Amir at Sulayil warned us that we should find no grazing other than acacias until near Laila, where there had been a little rain in the autumn. The first afternoon we overtook 2 Yam and a Dam, driving a couple of 100 white sheep and black goats to Laila for sale. We camped with them and bought a goat for our evening meal, which they shared with us. They were friendly and curious about our journey across the sands. The Dam had a blood feud with his own tribe and was living among the Yam. He told me that he had been in Najran in the summer when a Christian had come there from Abba and stayed for 2 days with Bin Mahdi, the Amir. He was amused when I told him that I was this Christian. He said he had seen me in the distance in the marketplace, but that I was then wearing different clothes. This was true, as at that time I was dressed as a Saudi. When we left them, They explained how to find the next well. There was a clearly marked track to Layla, and this route, surveyed by Philby, was shown on the map I had with me. The following afternoon, seeing dark clouds banking up in the west, I asked Muhammad, without thinking, if it would rain, and he answered immediately, "Only God knows." I should have realized that this would be his answer. No Bedou would ever express an opinion about the weather, since to do so would be to claim knowledge that belongs to God. I told him that in England wise men could foretell the weather, but this was almost blasphemy, and he exclaimed, "I seek refuge in God from the devil." The last 2 days before we reached Layla were bitterly cold, with a strong northeasterly wind. We rode across a stony plateau which sloped gently to the east. There was little vegetation until we were near the town, when the ground was suddenly covered with a small white flower called Rahath. We stopped early, so that the camels could have a good feed, and started late next morning. It was a pleasure to look round at sunset and see our camels lying down fully fed, instead of roaming about in their perpetual hungry quest for food. This was only the second time they had had enough to eat since we had left Manwak. Little did I know that it was going to take us another 40 days to reach Abu Dhabi, and that in all that time our camels would only get one more proper meal. After dark, we saw the lights of a car in the distance. Later we heard its engine racing, and realized that it was stuck in the sand. Resenting all cars, especially in Arabia, I was rather pleased that it was in trouble. The following afternoon we rode into Layla, a small, dun-coloured town of flat-roofed mud buildings, with a population of about 4,000. We halted outside the Amir's house, where we were told by a slave to unload our camels, and were then shown into a long dark room, bare of furnishings except for the rugs which covered the earthen benches round the walls. We greeted the Amir, a sour-faced elderly man called Fahad, who was wrapped in a gold-embroidered cloak. He called for coffee and tea, and then informed me in as few words as possible that Abdullah Philby had arrived yesterday by car from Riyadh, and not finding me here, had gone off to look for me. For the next 2 hours we sat in silence, which did not, however, prevent the Amir from making it quite clear how greatly he resented my presence. He left the room at sunset, and I went out into the courtyard to stretch my legs. I was looking at some Saker falcons, which were sitting hooded on their blocks, when I heard the call to prayer. Everyone else hurried off to the mosque, except some small boys who now crowded round and reviled me for being an infidel and for not praying. One little urchin explained at length that I was unclean. I was tired, irritated by their ill manners, and wished they would go away. Philby arrived about an hour later. He was an old friend of mine, and I was delighted to see him. His car had stuck in the sands while he was looking for us, and I realized that it was his lights which we had seen the night before. He said, "I happened to call on the king just after the telegram arrived, informing him that you and your party had turned up in Sulayil. He was absolutely furious, asked me if I knew who you were, then said he would make an example of you that would stop other unauthorized Europeans from entering his country. I tried to put in a word for you, but he wouldn't even let me open my mouth. I was worried what might happen to you and decided the best thing to do was to write him a letter. I gave it to him in the morning, saying as I did so that it was a man's duty to intercede for his friends. He was quite different from the night before, said at once that he would send off an order for your release." The Amir had pitched a tent for Philby in the space outside his house, and we went there after dinner and talked till nearly dawn. I grumbled about my churlish reception by the Amir that afternoon. Philby was sympathetic, but told me that I ought to realize that as a Christian I was anathema to these strict Wahhabis. He pointed out that, after all, it was only this rigid adherence to their principles, in a fast-changing world, that still preserved, in a few remote areas, the qualities which we both admired in the Arabs. To illustrate the length to which their Puritanism sometimes led them, he told me that once he was sitting with Ibn Saud on the palace roof in Riyadh, when they heard someone singing in the distance. Genuinely shocked, the king exclaimed, "God protect me! Who is that singing?" and sent an attendant to fetch the culprit. The man came back with a Bedou boy who had been driving camels into the town. Sternly the king asked the boy if he did not realize that to sing was to succumb to the temptings of the devil, and ordered him to be flogged. As Philby was anxious to visit Caria, to investigate the ruins which no European had yet seen, he left next day. But we remained for a further 24 hours in Layla, during which time the Amir left us without food. I did not see him again. I remained reading in the seclusion of the tent, interrupted by children peeping in, making rude remarks, and running away. Marashid tried to buy supplies for our journey, but were cursed and spat at for bringing an infidel into the town. The shopkeepers said that they would only accept our money after it had been publicly washed. This nicety did not, however, prevent them from charging us exorbitant prices, when eventually I got hold of some flour, rice, dates, and butter through the Amir's son. Muhammad asked the Amir to find us a guide to take us to Jabrin, but he answered, "I will encourage no man to travel with an infidel." The villagers had already declared that none of them would go with us, expressing the hope that we should die of thirst in the desert. They said that this was sure to happen, as no rain had fallen in the country between Layla and Jabrin, and consequently we should encounter no Bedou to direct us. Some of them horrified my companions by asking why they had not murdered me in the desert and gone off with my possessions. Bin Kabina kept muttering, "They are dogs, and sons of dogs. They say you are an infidel, but you are 100 times better than such Muslims as these." Layla had been one of the strongholds of the Akhwan, a militant religious brotherhood dedicated to the purification and the unification of Islam. This movement had aimed at breaking up the tribes and settling the Bedou round the wells and in the oases, since these fanatics regarded nomadic life as incompatible with strict conformity with Islam, which in their eyes entailed the scrupulous observance of fasts, prayers, and ablutions. Ibn Saud had risen to power on this movement, but later, when the Akhwan rebelled against him, accusing him of religious laxity because he forbade them to raid into the neighbouring states, he broke their power at the Battle of Sabila in 1928. Here in Layla, and in the Wadi Dawasir, the old fanaticism had survived. The hatred which I encountered was a disturbing experience. It was ugly, as is all hatred, and to me, accustomed to religious tolerance, it seemed senseless. But I wondered if it were not preferable to the new hatred based on distinctions of colour, nationality, and class, which our civilization has engendered, and which are convulsing the more sophisticated parts of the Middle East. In the early days of Islam, while their faith was still unchallenged, the Arabs were remarkably tolerant about religion. But to the people of Layla, I was an intruder from an alien civilization, which they identified with Christianity. They knew that the Christian had subjugated most of the Muslim world, and that contact with their civilization had everywhere destroyed or profoundly modified the beliefs, institutions, and culture they cherished. Naturally, they did not realize how little sympathy I had with the innovations and inventions with which they associated me, nor how much sympathy I had with the way of life they sought to preserve. In the evening, we discussed what we should do. Jabrin was about 150 miles away. But I was confident that I could get there by following Philby's route, which was shown on an otherwise blank map. I realized, however, that if I failed to find this oasis, we should be lost in the empty, waterless desert to the south of the Hassa. I suggested to the others that I should guide them, but they were naturally doubtful of my ability to find a place which I had never seen, and which was 8 days' journey away. I said, "We don't need a guide. I can find the way." Bin Gabesha asked, "How can you do that? You have never seen the country." I explained, "Abdullah Philby marked Jabrin on the map. I can find it with my compass." Muhammad was skeptical. "There are no landmarks. The way is across open plains, like the Jadat al-Harasis. It is different from the journey we have just made." "Then we did not need a guide. We knew the Arad was on our left. We had only to strike it to arrive at the Hasi. The Tsar knew the actual place of the well. Now we need a guide." I suggested that we should probably meet some Bedou on the way, but Amer said doubtfully, "They say here that the country is empty. There has been no rain." I went on, "Believe me, I can find Jabrin. By God, I don't want to die of thirst in the desert any more than you do." Bin Kabina asked, "How many days will it take?" I answered, 8. And he said, "That is what they say here." Eventually they agreed that I should guide them. Bin Gabesha said, "It is obvious we shall not find a guide here, and God forbid we should remain in Layla. We must put ourselves in Umbarak's hands." I asked if we should find Arabs at Jabrin, and Muhammad said, "We are bound to find Mura there. There are always some of them there. Don't worry about that, Umbarak. You just get us to Jabrin. Do that, and we shall be thankful." I sincerely hoped we should find Arabs at Jabrin. By then we should need more food, and what was far more important, we should need a guide to show us the waterholes on our way to Abu Dhabi, 400 miles farther on. Without a guide, we should be stranded at Jabrin, with worn-out camels, in the northern wastes of the empty quarter. It was not a pleasant thought. That evening Muhammad tried to give me some money. He said, "Abdullah Filby gave us this before he left. Here is a fifth of it, your share. We are travelling companions, and should share all things alike." We left Layla on the 7th of February. We carried 6 skins full of water, and had with us 90 pounds of flour, 15 pounds of rice, 30 pounds of dates, and some butter, sugar, tea, and coffee. The Amir's son pretended that he had difficulty in buying even this small quantity of food. As we were unlikely to get anything but dates from the Murar at Jabrin, I knew that we were going to be very hungry before we reached Abu Dhabi. I reckoned that it would take us at least a month to get there. We therefore decided to ration ourselves to 3 pounds of flour between the 5 of us for our one evening meal. We could use the rice only when we were on a well, and had plenty of water. We would eat the dates for breakfast, or rather they would, for by now I could no longer even stand the sight of dates. As we led our camels out of the town, some Arabs shouted to us not to come back if we failed to find the way. My diary shows that it took us 8 days to reach Jabrin, and records our marching hours, which were not really long, since only twice did we do 8 hours in a day. But my recollection is of riding interminably through a glaring, haze-bound wilderness, which seemed to be without beginning and without end. The weariness of our camels added to my own, making it barely tolerable, especially when their bodies jerked in flinching protest as they trod with their worn soles upon the flints, which strewed alike the hollows and the ridges. Sometimes we found a path, and its smooth surface afforded them temporary relief. But I dared not follow it if it deviated from my compass course, for there were no landmarks in this desert which I could recognize to warn me if I was going wrong. I knew that I should only have to be 8 or 10 miles out to miss Jabrin. Not much after 150 miles. Was Jabrin shown accurately on the map? Though Cheeseman and Philby were meticulously accurate in their work, both of them had fixed Jabrin after a long journey. I could not recall what method they had used. If they had fixed its position by compass traverse, a 10-mile error was possible. In the evening we camped wherever we could find a few bushes to give us fuel. We would turn the camels loose to search for food, and I would watch them hobbling away, heading back instinctively towards their homelands in the south. And as they got farther and farther away, adding yet more miles to the miles they had already covered that day, I would think wearily, "Now one of us will have to go and get them." If I started to do so, the others would jump up, saying, "We will get them, Umbarak." But sometimes I would insist, and, accompanied by one of them, would set off irritably in pursuit. To spare the camels, we were carrying little water, and during these days I was always thirsty and also hungry. For being thirsty, I found it difficult to swallow the heavy, unappetizing bread which Bin Kabina cooked. The weather was very cold, and on most nights we could see lightning and sometimes hear thunder, and I hoped it would not rain, for we would have no sort of shelter. On previous journeys, it had needed a conscious effort on my part to understand what my companion said. But now, although I still spoke Arabic haltingly, for I am a bad linguist, I could no longer withdraw into the sanctuary of my own mind, beyond reach of their disputes. I could follow their talk too easily. For one entire day, Bin Kabina and Mohammed argued about the money I had given them 2 years before at Tarim. On the ground that the camel which Bin Kabina had ridden belonged to him, Mohammed had kept 2/3 of the money which I had intended for Bin Kabina. Remembering how destitute Bin Kabina had been at the time, I thought this mean and said so. The argument went on, angry shouted interruptions, checking but not halting an endless flow of repetition. It only came to an end when we stopped for the night. They then sat contentedly together baking bread. Throughout another day, Bin Kabina and Amer wrangled continuously about the respective merits of their grandfathers. Bin Kabina said maliciously, "Anyway, my grandfather never farted in public," and the discomfited Amer blushed for this appalling solecism on the part of a grandfather who had been dead for 20 years. When next day they started to quarrel once more about their grandfathers, I protested. They looked at me in surprise and said, "But it passes the time," which I suppose was true. 2 days before we reached Debrin, we crossed the Dahana Sands, here about 15 miles wide. This belt of crescent dunes links the sands of the Empty Quarter with the great Nafud Sands in northern Arabia. Rain had fallen 2 months earlier, and had penetrated 3 feet into the sands, which were touched with a bloom of newly sprung seedlings. To me, the unexpected hint of spring in the drab monotony of those days was very welcome. On the 8th morning, we climbed a final ridge. I had calculated that if we were ever to see Jabrin, we should see it now. And there it lay, straight in front of us, the splashes of the palm groves dark on the khaki plain. I sat down on a tumulus to rest, for I was very tired, while the others broke into excited talk. Later, we went down into the plain and found a well near a grove of acacias. We watered the camels and turned them loose. They would no doubt find something, although even the acacias were leafless from the long drought. Only twice during the past 8 days had I noticed anything which I thought they could eat, but I suppose they must have found something more during those shuffling quests which took them so far afield. Bin Kabina may have noticed the compassion in my eyes, for he said, "Their patience is very wonderful. What other creature is as patient as a camel? That is the quality which above all else endears them to us Arabs." The well was shallow, and the water sweet. My companions stripped off their shirts and poured buckets of water over each other, but I shrank from this bitter washing in the cold wind, despite their jibes and encouragement. "Come on, Mubarak," called out Bin Gabesha, and denied that it was cold, although I could hear him gasp each time a mare threw water over him. He still wore his loincloth, but the water moulded it to him like draperies on a statue. All Arabs dislike uncovering themselves in public, but here this modesty seemed exaggerated. I contrasted it with the behaviour of other Bedou, with whom I had bathed in the Euphrates, who had chased each other naked along the river bank. Later, Mohammed and Amir went off to look for the Murra. We had been in the territory of this tribe since we had crossed the Dahana, and Mohammed was still confident that we should find some of them in this oasis. The Murra, one of the great tribes of the Najd, number between 5,000 and 10,000 persons, and live in an area as large as France. They guided Philby across the Empty Quarter, but their knowledge of it is limited to parts of the central and western sand, and they do not range anything like as widely as the Rashid, who may be met with from the borders of the Yemen to Oman, and from Darfur to Riyadh, the Hassa and the Trucial coast. The Murra have a great reputation in Saudi Arabia as trackers, and are widely employed by the government for tracking down criminals and identifying them from their footprints. The Murra, who was friendly to us in Solail, was so employed. While the others were away, we cooked a large meal of rice against their return, and then, while we lay idly around the fire, Bin Kabina and Bin Gabesha tried to teach me a game, rather like draughts, which they played with camel droppings in the sand. But either their explanations were too involved, or the game was too complicated, for I never understood it. When the others came back at sunset, they told us that they had found neither Arabs nor fresh tracks. They asked me how much farther I could guide them. Between here and Abu Dhabi,